Has anyone ever told you to get out of your head about something? Maybe thoughts are overwhelming you, or you're anxious about something, you're worried about something, you're overcome with dread. Or maybe you're rehashing something that happened and you're kind of playing it over and over again and you're living in regret about something that was in the past and you're ruminating and someone says to you, hey, just get out of your head. How do you possibly shut off a runaway mind? This is something that has mystified me ever since I was a wee lad. Ever since, in fact, I saw the original Ghostbusters movie. How many of you have seen the original Ghostbusters movie? Okay. If you haven't seen it, I'm going to spoil some of it for you, but in my defense, you've had plenty of time to watch it. I mean, it's an old movie. If you remember the original Ghostbusters movie, in the final kind of scene, there is this, you know, ghost villain speaking from high atop of this gothic building in New York, and the ghost villain basically tells the Ghostbusters that they're going to be able to choose their own destroyer. And, you know, they're kind of like, why would we choose a destroyer? And then Bill Murray's character realizes that what the ghost villain means is that they're going to use, the ghost's going to use their thoughts against them. And so he turns to all the Ghostbusters, and remember this? He says, I remember this very well. He says, empty your heads. Don't think of anything. And, of course, one guy can't do it, Dan Aykroyd. And so as a result comes walking down the street their final great destroyer. Do you remember who it was? That's right, the Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man. Because he couldn't clear his head. And I'm not kidding, for about a year after I saw that movie, in quiet moments when I was on my own in my room or I just didn't have anything to do and, you know, we didn't have phones to entertain ourselves or anything back then, I remember trying to empty my head. Just in case I ever needed to. I tried to really just put thoughts out of my mind to see what that was like, and I discovered that for me it was impossible. See, how do you shut off a runaway mind? I think we all realize that there are moments in life when we need a vacation from our brains. We need a vacation from our minds and the things that are going on there. And so we've adapted a couple of strategies to help us when we just need a break. Either we distract ourselves, you know, books, Netflix, scrolling through social media. Maybe we numb ourselves through food or drugs, alcohol, sex, things that are pleasurable that just kind of numb us from what's going on in our heads. And those can be effective strategies just to get us out of our mind for a little while. But we realize that those things come with a cost. You can't live your whole life distracted. You can't live your whole life numb. And so some of us, we decide, you know, if I'm going to deal with my mind, I better tackle it. And we tackle it head on. And we try to heal our mind through our minds. And maybe we go see a mental health professional, a psychiatrist, or a counselor to help us get at what's going wrong in our minds through our minds. And that's kind of how we attempt to deal with most problems, right? When something breaks, we go to a specialist to fix it. And that's even true with us. When there's a piece of us that breaks, we try to go find a specialist to fix it. So if we're sick in our bodies, we think about nutrition or exercise, or we go find a physical therapist or an internist, someone who can heal our body through our bodies. Same thing's true with us spiritually. When we're not feeling it spiritually or we feel spiritually unhealthy, we seek out a healer or a pastor or maybe a priest to confess to, or if you've really got spiritual issues, maybe an exorcist. You know, if you got it bad, I don't know, that's okay. All said, we tend to take a very compartmentalized, segmented view of ourselves. And the reason we do is because of the Greeks. We have the Greeks to thank for this view of ourselves. Anyone Greek, have Greek heritage? If so, thank you. Thank you for your contribution. Going all the way back to Plato, you've heard of him, Plato, the old ancient Greek philosopher, gave us a worldview that I think we still hold on to. And the worldview looks something like this, that reality is divided amongst two primary realms. There is a spiritual realm, and the spiritual realm is where truth is, where purity is. That's our origin and our destiny. That's where true values, true ideals, virtues, true spirits live in this world. That's kind of the reality that we're striving for. That's what's ultimately good, and that's where we want to get to. But there's also a physical world. So there's a spiritual world, this ideal world, the world of forms, and then there's this material or physical world. And the material physical world, according to Greek philosophy is kind of where all of these pure things are now imprisoned. And the goal of life is eventually to escape the physical or material world and to get back to the realm of spiritual things where we can be pure, untainted, virtuous again in this spiritual realm. And here's what's crazy. Whether you know about Greek philosophy or not, whether you're bored completely by what I just said or not, the truth is this has infiltrated Christian thought. Because now when I ask you to describe heaven, if I said, hey, what is heaven? Chances are you're going to say something like I just said. It's when we get to escape this corrupted, polluted planet we're living on, this decaying planet, and our sinful bodies, our decaying bodies, and we get to fly away to a realm of pure spiritual things where virtue and truth lives in an untainted way. The only problem is that this view is not biblical. It's Greek, but it's not biblical. See, the Bible's view and the worldview that we're given by the Bible is one of integration. In Hebrew, as opposed to Greek, and when I mean Hebrew, I'm referring to God's Old Testament people, a nation, a language, a culture, and a worldview. The Hebrew worldview is very different than the Greek worldview, and this is more important than we might think. See, according to the Hebrew worldview, we are one integrated person. Even in the Hebrew worldview, God is one. There's this great rallying cry or motto of the Hebrew people still used by Jewish people today. It's called the Shema from Deuteronomy 6. And look how it goes. It says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." And so even today, modern day Jews would say, "Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad." That's all of my seminary education for you. I got nothing else, but that's just proof. I spent a lot of time and money on seminary. But right, you see this, that God is one. God in his being is integrated, and this is still such a foundational truth of Christianity and Judaism. And then it goes on and it says, "Now love the Lord your God," speaking to us, "with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength." And this is where Greeks start to go crazy, and they start to try to diagram all these, and they're like, "Okay, what's our heart? Our heart is maybe our emotions, our feeling. Well, I don't know. What's our soul? I don't know. Our strength? What's our strength?" But for Hebrews, they didn't think about us in segments or in compartments. In Hebrew, all of these words are actually pretty loose and messy. They can mean a lot of things. In Hebrew, what we're learning here is that we are to love the Lord our God with all of us, with all of our being, with everything we have. They're more like piling on superlatives, not different compartments of who we are, because the Hebrew view is one of integration, not compartmentalization, not segmentation. Now, there are lots of differences between Hebrew thought and Greek thought, and again, I don't want to get too down into the weeds on this, but I will say this, for Greeks, more horrifying than probably anything else in the Hebrew worldview was the Hebrew explanation, the biblical explanation of creation. See, for Greeks, this idea that the one true high God, and we know Greek philosophy had a lot of different gods, but the one true high God, that he would create intentionally a physical world, that just was beyond the scope of what Greeks could imagine, because the physical material world was kind of corrupt or fallen. It was so beneath a pure spiritual God. But even worse from Genesis is not the creation of the earth. Even worse for Greeks was how God created us. See, Genesis 2, after this, it says, after God's created the heavens and the earth, it says, "Now no shrub had yet appeared on the earth, and no plant had yet sprung up, for the Lord God had not sent rain on the earth, and there was no one to work the ground." This is before humans, the created world is complete. "But streams came up from the earth and watered the whole surface of the ground. Then the Lord God formed a man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life." Some of you are already grossed out by this, and the Greeks were even more grossed out by it. "And the man became a living being." The idea for Greeks that, again, this high created God, creator God, that he would not only make the world, but that he would literally get his hands dirty making a man, and then he would do this very intimate, defiling thing, you know, divine mouth to mouth, except with his nostrils, he would breathe into the man the breath of life. This was just appalling to Greeks. They could not accept this. And yet for Hebrews, and I hope today, even though I think we've been more influenced by Greek culture in a lot of ways than Hebrew culture, I hope today you can become a little more Hebrew and see this not as defiling or absurd or gross, but instead to see it as powerful. Because what this means is that there's integration, there's unity even between God and us on a created level, right? God breathes his breath, and the Hebrew word breath also means spirit. God breathes his spirit into us. That means that there is unity, that we share in the very breath, we share in the very spirit of God. And not only that, but there's unity in our created being. We are not a spirit trapped in a physical body that's corrupt and evil or fallen. Instead, we are a whole being. Now, the Greeks, again, they didn't like this. And that's why for a lot of us, when we later on in the New Testament hear that word sarx, which is translated flesh, I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, we assume that flesh, the sinful flesh, means sinful physical bodies. That's because Greek thought has influenced our thinking. But for Hebrews, that wasn't the case. In Genesis, we're confronted with a different view that the whole created world is good. And that includes us, an integrated body and soul, a whole person who isn't divided into compartments, but is completely integrated. Now, I realize that this is only half the story, though, creation. Even if we can accept this, we were taught that Genesis 3 comes along, sin enters the world, messes everything up, and so now basically we're living in the world as the Greeks described it. Creation is crumbling, our bodies are falling apart and sinful, and our only hope is to fly away from all of this physical material world and to enter into this heavenly realm. It sounds familiar, right? Except that's not biblical either. That's not Christian. I want you to see what Paul says lots of years later. This is Paul speaking to a very Greek-minded city, the city of Corinth. And he's talking about something, again, that would be appalling for most Greek-minded people. He's talking about a physical resurrection. He says this, "But if it's preached that Christ has been raised from the dead," which is something we preach, "how can some of you say that there is no resurrection of the dead?" Now, the resurrection he's talking about here is not just a spiritual resurrection. It is also a bodily resurrection. This was a mainstay of Jewish theology. It affected everything, and it was kind of peculiar. Most people didn't believe in a physical bodily resurrection at the end of time, but Jewish people did. And so it affected their burial practices. This is why Jewish people did not practice cremation. This is why, if you know the Old Testament story of the patriarch Joseph, aka Donny Osmond, now you know, right? That's why even when he was prepared to die in Egypt and God's people were living in a foreign land, he said to his family, he said, "Hey, I'm going to die and you're going to put my bones here, but don't leave me here. When you go back up to the promised land, make sure you take my bones with you." That's a weird request, isn't it? But for Joseph, he's saying, "Hey, when the resurrection of the body happens, I don't want to be raised up in the wrong country. Right? I don't want to be found in Egypt. I want to be in the promised land where God's people are." And so this was a deeply held conviction of Jewish people. But in Paul's day, thanks to Greek thinking, it started to come under fire. And people started to say, no, I mean, there can't possibly be a physical resurrection because our bodies are bad. They're corrupted. They're going to die. They just need to go into the ground. We need to be done with those things. But Paul says this later on, verse 20. He says, "But Christ has indeed been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. For since death came through a man, Adam, the resurrection of the dead comes also through a man, Jesus. For as in Adam all die, so in Christ all will be made alive. But each in turn, and in the same way, Christ, the first fruits, then when he comes back, all of us, all of those who belong to him." See, Paul says, and again, this is biblical, that Jesus is our model. If Jesus was raised, so will we. That's his argument. But Jesus is the model or the pattern for how this will happen. Jesus is the first fruits. So our resurrection, Paul says, will be like Jesus' resurrection, which means a physical, bodily resurrection. Now, maybe this is something you know. I don't think this is something we think about very much, frankly. I've done a lot of funerals, and I've heard the things that we say in those things. We act like the body doesn't matter, and that part of us is done, and we just go on and live pure spirit. But Paul was adamant about this. That's not a biblical view. And yet he knows he's talking to very Greek people, and so he goes on and he tries to explain it a little bit more. And if you've ever been to a graveside funeral service, you've probably heard these words read. He says, "Listen, I tell you a mystery. I know this is hard to understand, that we will not all sleep, but we will all be changed in a flash, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet." In other words, when Jesus comes back, we're going to be changed. He goes on and he says, "For the trumpet will sound, and the dead, the physically dead, our bodies will be raised imperishable, and we will be changed." And he's anticipating an objection to say, but how can a corrupted fallen body, how can that ever be raised? And he says, hey, it's not that these things are just kind of disposable or throw away. You're right, something has to happen, but here's what's got to happen. The perishable must clothe itself with the imperishable, and the mortal with immortality. Paul's saying, it's not that this is a throwaway body and the physical creation is a throwaway creation. And this is important for everything, including just our stewardship of the earth. But Paul says, it's not just that they're throwaway. Yeah, they're corruptible and they're perishable and they're mortal. But what Jesus will do is not throw those things away, but he'll clothe them with something that makes them lasting. He goes on and he says, "When the perishable has been clothed with the imperishable and the mortal with immortality, then the saying that is written will come true. Death has been swallowed up in victory." Now, maybe in all that perishable, corruptible stuff, you're lost. So let me get to the bottom line for you. From creation all the way through redemption to the very end of time, the Bible teaches that we are one whole, integrated being. We are not compartments. We are not eternal spirits trapped in a physical body. And more, the Bible teaches from beginning to end that God's redemption of us. And by redemption means to buy something back or to reclaim something, to renew something. God's redemption of us will be a whole being redemption. Now, I just want you to sit with that for a second. This truth that God is redeeming every part of us. And just hang there for a minute. That means that there is not a part of you, of your created being, and more, there is not a part of your story, of your journey with all of its twists and turns and its ups and downs, that God doesn't have the power to heal and a plan to redeem. I just want to say that again because I don't think we know this. I think we assume that there are parts of us that God is concerned with and parts of us that are not his concern. And yet I want you to know there's not a piece of your being or a part of your story that God doesn't have the power to heal or a plan to redeem. And see, in our time, we're obsessed with trying to trace out the roots of things, and that includes the roots of our dysfunction or our brokenness or our sin. And so we wonder, you know, is the reason that I am the way I am, is it nature or is it nurture? Is it in my mind? Is it emotional stuff? Is it my attachments growing up or the fact that I didn't have attachments? Is it in my biology? Is it a part of my DNA? Right? We try to figure out the source and the root of all of our problems, but does that even matter? I find that so unhelpfully Greek, even though I do it. See, here's the truth, that our brokenness, our sinfulness, wherever it comes from, whatever the origin is, it affects all of us. It brings death into our whole being. And it brings chaos into our world. And it affects every part of our lives, and not just our lives, but every part of the people's lives that we love. It doesn't matter where it comes from. It has a whole life effect. But here's the good news. Wherever it comes from, Jesus came into the world to redeem all of it. Again, there is not a part of your created being, and there is not a part of your story that God doesn't have the power to heal or a plan to redeem. There's hope for every part of you. And practically speaking, you know what that means? That means that when you've got something broken inside of you, whether it's a broken body or a broken spirit or a broken mind, you don't have to just fix it through that channel, that we've got as a whole being all of these different levers that God has put into us that can bring healing to all of us. Now, there are lots of applications for this, but for this series, here's where I want to go. That when you've got that runaway mind, when you're anxious, when you're thinking about something hanging over your head, I'm going on sabbatical on Friday, and I'm both excited and so anxious. I'm going to be away for 6 weeks. Part of that time, I'm going to be completely away from my family, out of contact with my family, and right, I mean, even good things, we can run ahead, and when your mind is racing and you're projecting yourself there, or maybe you're back in the past and you're feeling regretful and you're feeling shame about something and that's overtaken you. See, here's the good news, that God has given you multiple levers, resources within your created being to bring peace to your being. And one of the greatest things that God has given us that we just completely neglect because we're so Greek in our thinking is that one of the built-in solutions that God has given you to heal your mind is actually your body. If you ever need to get out of your head, just try getting into your body. See, for starters, our body is the only part of us that has to be present. Right? Your body can't live in the future with your anxieties or dreads or worries. Your body can't live in the past with your trauma or your regret. Your body is always right here, right now, in the present moment, which is a very good thing. If we could just learn to be present, half of our mental health issues would go away, and our body's here to help us do that. If we can just stay in our body, then that means we stay right here and we're not drifting back to the past, we're not running ahead to the future. Not only that, we're learning scientifically even that this Hebrew idea of integration, it's not simplistic. I mean, we think about these people as like almost cavemen who knew nothing, and yet God had revealed some incredible wisdom to them, and we're learning that within our bodies, we've got all of these resources to bring healing to our minds. For instance, do you know that there are more nerve receptors in your gut than anywhere else in your body other than your brain? Not only that, do you know that your gut is lined with cells? And for a while, we thought these cells were just hormone-producing cells that told us when we were full or when we were hungry, kind of the slow boat back up to our brains to let us know. We're actually discovering that those cells look almost exactly like neurons, and they form a backdoor neural pathway straight from our guts up to our brains. Which is both cool, but it's also really practical because other studies have been done with anxious mice. Now, I don't know what mice have to be anxious about. And yet apparently they struggle with this whole thing too. But they've given certain probiotics to anxious mice to heal their guts. And right away that begins to bring a lessened sense of anxiety to their minds. We also know how this works vice versa, the alternate way, right? When we're anxious in our minds, it can cause all kinds of bodily problems and even autoimmune diseases. They're looking at new treatments that have nothing to do with our body, but they begin to just focus on our minds and how our minds can bring healing to our bodies and vice versa. When our guts are healthy, our minds get healthier. We know this. We know that our diet helps us. Basically, again, credible sources. If you eat a whole food, non-processed diet, even if you have a depression diagnosis, it'll make you feel better. We know this about exercise, that if we get out there and exercise, it's an all-natural treatment to fight depression. And yet, here's what I also realized, that when you're not feeling good, when you're anxious or you're depressed or you're struggling mentally, it's hard to make a home-cooked whole food meal. You just want the bad stuff, right? And it's hard to get up and exercise when you're not feeling good. And I understand that. So there's one other thing that we're just beginning to really understand this again. And I think our ancestors understood it. We're just getting to understand it again. There's one other thing that God has given us, a built-in lever that you carry with you all the time, and it's so accessible wherever you are, whenever you need it, and that is your breath, right? Ease anxiety and stress. Just take a belly breather. And science is beginning to understand that breath is more important to our mental health than anyone realized. Even with exercise, there's research that says that the main point of cardio exercise is, yeah, get your blood pumping, makes you feel strong, burns off some stress, but primarily that's through the breath because you can't run or bike or even walk at a quick pace and not breathe a little more deeply. It's part of the reason that throughout spirituality of monks and Gregorian monasteries that they use chanting, singing, right? Have you ever sung at the top of your lungs and you get that rush? It's not only the oxygen to our brains, but it's just the way that breath has a way of bringing peace to our bodies. That's why you should sing in church, even if you don't like the song or if you're not a singer. It's true. You can't help but breathe when you sing, and breathing seems like a natural thing, and yet research shows that we don't do it very well and we don't do it very often. For me, that's why I've discovered more benefits with yoga, not the weird kind of yoga, but the yoga that's just like breath and movement. That if I can learn to mindfully breathe while I'm moving, well, that's kind of what I do all day long. I'm moving, and if I can learn to breathe through that and breathe through stressful situations, then that has an effect on me. I even have a hypothesis for those of you who, when you get really worked up about something, you find yourselves crying, not just moist eyes, but you know, that kind of bawling crying. I think that's your body's way of just trying to encourage you to breathe when you're really worked up or really stressed out about something. See, we're discovering that when you breathe, especially when you exhale deeply, you not only give your blood oxygen, but you begin to stimulate a part of your body called the vagus nerve. It's part of your nervous system. In your nervous system, you have a sympathetic nervous system and a parasympathetic nervous system. If you don't like science, just hold through this. It's practical in a second. Your sympathetic nervous system is the part of the nervous system we go to all the time. That's what triggers fight or flight. We stimulate it through confrontation, through coffee or stimulants. It's the part of us that gets us going, fight or flight. You know, it's the cortisol thing that gets our stress hormones up. That's our sympathetic nervous system. But you have another part of your nervous system. It's called your parasympathetic nervous system. And science is beginning to discover that this parasympathetic nervous system, and the parasympathetic nervous system, if the one is fight or flight, the parasympathetic is rest and relax. It's the digest and chill part of your nervous system. And science is beginning to discover that there is a way that all of us can flip the switch, turn on our parasympathetic nervous system when the other side of our nervous system is going out of whack. It's going crazy and we're all worked up. And that's through our vagus nerve. The vagus nerve is located just kind of right here on either side of your neck. So part of the way you can stimulate it is just by putting your chin to your chest. It's a way to even physically, mechanically stimulate your vagus nerve. But what we also know is that the way to really stimulate your vagus nerve is by taking deep breaths. Ideally, about 6 breaths a minute. So that's 5-second inhale, 5-second exhale. In, out. And when we do that, there are these receptors in our lungs when we're really breathing. And those receptors get stretched, and they begin to stimulate the vagus nerve. And once the vagus nerve is stimulated, do you know what happens? It begins to lower your heart rate. And with a lower heart rate, a bunch of different endocrine systems and body systems begin to function differently. Your cortisol drops. Some of those stress responses drop. And instead of being fight and flight, you begin to be in this rest and relax, digest and chill place. And we can manipulate that simply through our breath. And if this comes as a surprise to anyone, it shouldn't. Because remember what we learned about ourselves in the very beginning? And in the very beginning of time, what transformed us from being a dust creature to a living being was breath. The breath of God, the Spirit of God, the breath of God into our nostrils, the breath of life. Breath is life. And this was revealed to us in Genesis, and now science is like, whoa, did you know that breathing is life? And through breathing, we can bring greater wholeness and fullness and peace into our bodies. And we say, I guess we should have known it was in Genesis. See, here's what's amazing to me, that God has put into our bodies this physical mechanism that we can use to quiet our minds and to bring peace to our spirits. And what this shows me about God is that he's a God who desperately wants us to have peace, not just spiritual level peace. We act as if God is only concerned with our so-called spiritual side, but God wants us to have peace in a whole life, whole being level. After all, Jesus came not as a spirit, he came in flesh, right? And he gave his life as a peace offering, a whole being peace offering for all of us. And even now, Jesus is still in flesh. He shares in our being, and that means God is concerned with every part of you. There is not a part of your being, and there's not a part of your story that God does not have the power to heal and a plan to redeem. And sometimes it starts as simply as going back to Genesis, going back to our breath. So right now, I want you to do something. I'm gonna invite us just to try this physical, amazing reset that God has given us. So feet flat on the floor, you gotta uncross your legs and sit up, feet flat on the floor. It's just kind of a reminder that we're present, right? Feel the weight of your feet on the floor. You're here now. This is where you are. Just a great way to stay anchored. And then go ahead and open up your hands, because I often carry a lot of stress in my body, but when I open my hands, a lot of the stress that I carry up here just goes away. It's hard to keep tension in your body when your hands are open and receiving like this. So chin to chest, open hands, put your chin to your chest. Just kind of stimulate that vagus nerve as comfortable as you can. Maybe you're tight there and that's okay. And then I'm gonna invite you just to take in a nice, slow, deep breath in through your nose, right? In through our nostrils, God breathed, not through our mouths. We're made to breathe through our noses. Out through the mouth. And just do that a few more times. And as you exhale, just let your body rest. Let the weight of your body sink in. Sometimes we act like we have to carry the weight of the world on our shoulders. But we were not meant to create the weight of the world. God made this big, sturdy world to hold us. So as you exhale, just kind of sink in. Let the weight of your body just sink down. And you can try to breathe in through your nose and out through your nose. It increases our breathing capacity, our oxygen absorption, to breathe in and out through our nose. Something we can practice to get better at it. Just let your mind follow your breath. Just rest right here, right now. Keep breathing while I pray. God, we thank you for breathing into us the breath of life, that we share in our created being your breath, your spirit. Thank you. And God, we acknowledge today that when we're breathing right now, we're looking for more than just oxygen. We're looking to you to breathe into us your healing, vivifying, renewing spirit all over again. Your spirit that's been made available to all of us on Pentecost. Your spirit who made us alive in Genesis, who continues to make us alive, your spirit who makes us new. Thank you for your spirit. And God, thank you for the gift of our bodies. They don't always work right. And yet through them, you've just done something masterful and wonderful and integrated. God, teach us more and more about how we can honor our bodies and how we can use our bodies to bring greater peace to our minds and wholeness to our spirits, and we can live as integrated beings. And God, just give us the reminder this week that we can always just pause and breathe. And as we're breathing, we can access you. And you're so willing to come to us and pour out your life and your spirit on us all over again. God, we thank you. In Jesus' name, amen. Last week, we had a confession, two weeks ago, from Psalm 139. I invite you to read these words with me from Psalm 139. Let's read these together. Search me, God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. As you just ponder those words, I'm going to invite you to keep your hands open as a physical just reminder to yourself that we're not asking God to break down the front door. We're saying, God, I'm open. Just come and search me. I don't want to fight. I don't want to resist. I invite you to come in and sweep through my mind and my heart and find those anxious thoughts and trace those things out in me. But our open hands are also a reminder that when we allow God to do that, we're expecting to receive. That he doesn't come just to search out and investigate so he can judge and critique, but instead, he wants to bring healing to those anxious places. He wants to bring light to those dark places. So we keep our hands open as both a sign of surrender, we're not going to fight you, God, but also a sign of inviting God. We expect to receive from you what we need to be made alive again. And then again, I'll just invite you to put your chin to your chest as you meditate on these words and do what they say as a sign of reverence and humility, not out of fear of God, but out of reverence for his great power and might. And with your hands open and your breath going and your chin to your chest, just invite God to search you and to bring life to every part of you as you confess. Take a moment.